Thanks for listening to The World We Deserve, the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's True Detective Anthology, brought to you by Bald Move.
This conversation covers Season 2, Episode 6, titled Church in Ruins.
The war was lost, the treaty signed, a was not cut across the line. A was not cut, though many tried, a live among you, well disguised.
Ray and Frank have a showdown over the identity of his wife's attacker. Frank denies that he knew it was the wrong man, claiming someone else, someone whose identity he can't or won't reveal, gave him the information and he was just passing it along. After doing what he can to comfort Stan's grieving family, Frank continues to search for the hard drive. He goes to the Mexican drug dealers and a woman named Irina, who tell him that a thin cop came asking around.
So it took 6 hours of watching True Detective, but they finally got me on one of these episodes.
Oh, they got you, huh?
Yeah, they got me. I really liked this episode a lot.
Sprayed that pure Molly right in your mouth.
Maybe.
Had you puking rainbows.
That's what it took. I had some hallucinations where Nick Pizzolatto with a beard was coming after me.
Uh-huh.
And then I just really liked this episode a lot.
I think it was, I mean, if nothing else, it was entertaining top to bottom. Like, it had a really epic Frank and Ray showdown, which I thought felt genuine and well written, for the most part well acted. It had a raid on the sex party that, while I'm not sure I fully understand why they're there and what they're trying to accomplish, was at least suspenseful and high stakes for characters that I feel something about.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, this was I was kind of hooked on episode 2 and episode 4. Maybe it's the even. It's like the Star Trek theory. It's the even episodes or the home runs here.
Yeah.
But I feel like we're rounding into seeing a final two episodes where this might all kind of hang together and be mind-blowing, which
I hope so.
Would be the inverse of last season, where I think the first half and, you know, trailing into episode 5 was the most exciting, intense parts. And then we just kind of wound down the series. It'd be kind of a neat inversion if the last three episodes really kind of tied everything into a bow and we're still kind of have things up in the air that get nailed down in an exciting way.
All right. I mean, yeah, I think, you know, with two episodes to go, they have a lot of ground to cover.
Sure.
There are a lot of loose ends to tie up, and I can see people, if they don't tie up the vast majority of these questions that we all have, people might not be satisfied with that.
I will say that something came in on the feedback, the feedback mailbag. So I strapped it on, and Jake from Tallahassee dropped a dime and said that the next two episodes are going to be supersized.
Okay.
Episode 7 is listed at 65-minute runtime and finale at 87 minutes. So you've got roughly 2.5 to 2.75 episodes to go in real kind of screen time. So maybe that gives it more time to kind of wind things down than I was suspecting. I was thinking,
yeah, an hour more.
So
sure. And with a 8-episode series, you kind of got to assume they're going to move pretty fast anyway.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in seeing the rest of this thing than I was last week. I can tell you that. The first 5 episodes of this didn't do much for me.
No, I felt, you know, I said on Facebook and the forums that I kind of felt validated as a fan, and I'm not sure if that's an accurate way of how I feel, because still, like, you know, I'm still looking for them to connect the, you know, Ray's apparent death at the end of episode 2 and some of this raid stuff that we saw and have it pay off. But this episode gives me a little bit more faith that they have the capability and the realization that they need to start paying the stuff off.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. There are some things I want to talk about, you know, directly about the scenes here, just kind of what I thought about it. Like that first scene with Ray and Frank just kind of sitting at the table.
Yeah.
We all kind of knew there wasn't going to be a gun battle right in Frank's living room. Or at least we were guessing. that seemed to be the prevailing opinion last week on the podcast.
I will say that it definitely charged up that episode because they both had the guns pointed under the table. We knew that.
Yeah.
I think they both knew that too. And I also knew that Ray probably didn't care whether he lived or died.
Mm-hmm.
Frank, I think, does care. So that gave it a lot of really useful tension. The big question I have is Frank being straight with Ray.
That's a good
what's
question.
What's your gut tell you?
My gut tells me yes.
My gut says yes too.
I mean, maybe I'm a sucker and I'm buying what he says about his sense of justice and all that stuff. But yeah, my gut says yes.
So let's talk about the evidence against, because I don't think there's any evidence for other than the gut.
Sure.
Know?
It's the gut and, you know, the pattern of behavior, because you have to look at some of his other actions. And from what I've seen, Frank is an honest guy. Like he doesn't necessarily lie to people. Yes, he intimidates. Yes, he manipulates in certain ways, but I've not seen him lie, really.
No, he seems like old school Godfather. Like, yeah. I have a sense of propriety. I might be ruthless to my enemies and people that are outside the, you know, mm-hmm. that are not civilians, but he seems to be kind of disturbed by people doing things to children, by people doing things to people he consider innocents. That's
but on the other hand, the thing that's kind of sticking in my craw here is he does withhold information.
Well, and I felt like he was a little cagey about his sources here. Like, on the one hand, this is what, 10, 12 years ago? So, and he's mm-hmm. a different person now. He's moved up the ladder. He's gone legitimate. Some of these contacts to, you know, crank yankers or crankheads or whatever are probably stale. Probably going to need some
sure.
some gangster investigation legwork.
Yeah, but he's been stirring up old paint for a while now, right?
I felt like he was a little cagey. Like, there was something shifty about Vince Vaughn's eyes. And Vince Vaughn's got shifty eyes. There's something a little shifty in those beady little eyes when Ray was trying to get the brass tacks about, like, I need to talk to this rapist. Or I need to talk to the guy who gave you that name.
Yeah, and also, you know, the hard drive thing, right? That's another part of it. He says, once he's kind of back on Frank's side, Ray's like, who's this hard drive guy? Who wants it? And Frank's like, it's a corporate guy.
Yeah.
He could have given a lot more information there. He could have said, it's Catalyst. Here's his name. Here's how you get a hold of him.
M.O. He's kind of...
That's what I mean. Yeah. And that's why I don't totally trust Frank at this point, is that he withholds a lot of information that might be vital to him getting the mission accomplished, you know?
So there's two other things. I also felt like him saying, you might be the only friend I've got, that felt like a genuine moment.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, when his wife Jordan comes out with her gun, which was pretty cool. I mean, that's...
I totally forgot she was even in that room.
And it's a total noir thing, her coming out with her little silk dressing and holding the revolver and kind of vamping into the room.
Yeah.
The look they shared, I mean, it could just be just pure relief tension, but it's almost like, oh, wow, that could have gone... And I guess that's true. That could have gone bad. Mm-hmm. But there's a little bit of, maybe we got away with something.
Oh, like... He doesn't know, or that kind of thing?
Or that was on Frank's face. I don't know about Jordan, because I don't know if Jordan knows either way.
Hmm.
It's too early for the psychosphere, but I've got a crazy theory about what's going on here.
Okay.
We know that the Mayor Chisani, the Mayor Vinci, has... Well, we don't know this, but we, you know, talking stuff in the psychosphere, we think that there's been this cycle of... I can't even call it a cycle. Damn it, I'm... destroying my theory as I'm talking about it. Frank inherited the poker room and the Lux and his clubs and all that from some other guy, it seems like. And he was named. Maybe he was displaced. Maybe he retired, you know, Joe the Boss style, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that the mayor has been at least telling Frank that he's entertained offers from other up-and-comers. We know that Blake is... one of those up-and-comers. It seems like he's been trying to step out on his boss.
Seems like it.
So we also know that the mayor is getting pissed off and tired of all the shenanigans with Frank coming into his office and kind of rolling tough on him and kicking around his deal with the, you know, Casper and all this stuff. Who stands the most gain from this total stranger coming into the plot with DNA evidence connecting him to his wife's rapist? Who stands the most to gain this split Frank's, you know, strongman away from him at this crucial moment? It's Mayor Chisani, right?
I suppose so. Like, of the players we know, I guess so, yeah.
We also know that the state's attorney general.
Blake probably does.
The state's attorney general who did this, all this back scratch and handshake and bullshit deal with the mayor and the city of Vinci, and kind of swept all this under the rug. And now he's running it for governor on the platform of eliminating corruption. We know he's super corrupt, and also he is like the top lawman. And it would be fairly trivial for him to insert this kind of crazy bogus evidence, DNA evidence, that would incriminate Frank and Ray. And finally, when Ray went to confront the rapist in prison, the guy looks nothing like Chad, which I understand. This, you know, it's kind of like Game of Thrones. Like, genetics doesn't always work that way. You know, like, you can have redheads, skip generations, all this stuff. But cinematically, I think it's kind of like, you know, the seed is strong situation.
Sure.
He doesn't look anything like this guy. And he's saying stuff like, you know, I'm a little messed up in the head and they're telling me I did all these things. He seems like a patsy. Now, he could just be saying that, but he didn't give the performance indicating that he was just saying that. I feel like these are things he truly believed. Yeah. So you get a guy who's kind of addled in the head, has got a history of mental illness. You pin some bogus DNA evidence on it. You know that's going to get back to Ray and Frank. They're going to be at each other's throats. I wonder if this is actually some kind of red herring and Ray did kill the right guy.
I mean, yeah, it's not impossible. Sure.
What problems do you have with that theory?
That it's a lot of speculation and a lot of assumptions. I mean, I feel like we're encouraged to do that, though.
Sure, sure.
That's I'm not dinging you for that. I'm just saying.
Is there any actual evidence? Is there something I'm looking at that would actually be a directly contraindicator of this thing?
Not that I can tell, no.
Other than the fact that DNA evidence does connect this man to his wife's rapist.
Yeah, I mean, you're going more conspiratorial.
Yeah.
Which I think is warranted in this show.
Okay. All right. But I think that's
I'm not going to put up too much of a fight against that.
I don't know where this ends up because it didn't work. I do think that by the end of this episode, Ray and Frank are back to being true blue.
Seems like it. Yeah.
But there's another theory I have, which is all this evidence they got, which we're going to talk about, you know, but all these contracts and the person they kidnapped, none of this is really great evidence since it was essentially an unlawful break and entering and, there's people killed, all that stuff. It's not going to hold up in a court of law, but it might be similar to the arc that kind of Marty and Russ went on last year where they were kind of renegade ex-policemen. We have two renegade members. We have an ex-cop in Ray, and we have a kind of a morally upstanding mini godfather in Frank. It could be that this is Annie and Paul turning over information for them to get the justice. Because how do you fight a system that's corrupt all the way to the top badge in the state that potentially could be the governor?
Yeah,
he's literally the top executive officer in the state. How do you fight that?
How do you fight the system from within?
You can't. Yeah. Not when the system's that corrupt.
Sure.
So, and how do you fight against Vinci? It's a fake town that has no voting populace. It's just, it's a plutocracy. What do you do? So, you know, you fight the sprawl by putting on black mask and fucking shit up. I mean, it's the Batman theory of justice.
Yeah, it's exactly what they did this episode. And I mean, they're halfway like to being state sanctioned or something. I mean, she's clearly assembling a task force that's supposed to be off the radar, but I got the impression last episode that there's some kind of sanctioning of this.
Well, I mean,
so like, I can imagine there could be some big blowback on her.
But that's the thing. So D'Angelo's mom, who's now the state attorney that's kind of sponsoring this quasi black ops.
Yeah, I don't understand how it actually works within the legal system.
I don't either. How do you keep the left hand from knowing what the right hand's doing? But
and still have it be legal.
I mean, she said a lot of buzzwords like off the radar and no pings and you know, independent contractors and budgets off books and like so I feel like yes, we don't really understand how all the sausage's made, but nevertheless it's coming out. She seems pretty obtuse.
In what way?
Like this murder shack being a mile or two away from this club that we know has these photographs being taken and these rich and powerful people there, to just brush that off is like, don't you have other things to do? And then when the sheriff from the, is it Sonoma County sheriff? Whoever has jurisdiction over the sex club and the murder shack comes in there and they're like, hey man, this is our crime scene. Get the fuck out of here. Now that could just be interdepartmental dick swinging.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something you see every other episode in Justified.
Sure. And seen
no
a lot of that.
No one's like, oh, this is corrupt head to toe. Mm-hmm. It's a standard cop trope, that kind of standoffishness. But in this show, that's kind of suspicious. And she sees that and she knows they're fighting a conspiracy that goes literally to the top. So why is she being so kind of obtuse? Annie goes in there and this crazy dangerous mission to generate enough actionable stuff for her to take this all seriously.
She feels more to me like she's just going to leave it to this group she's assembled. Like, she's just going to kind of step back and not really deal with this.
I just wonder what she's going to do when she finds out that this has happened.
That's a really good question.
Because, yeah, I don't...
She's got to be pissed, right? Because, like I said, it's got to come back on her if this is any kind of official squad.
But if it's not, I feel like there's, you know, I've always heard, like, in other works of fiction where cops get things obtained illegally, but they kind of, like, reverse engineer it. Like, okay, knowing this information, we won't use any of this evidence, but we'll use this information we have in our head to actually find evidence that we generate legitimately.
Sure.
And I think that if that veil gets pierced in court of law, it's game over. Yeah. But I feel like that's something one can do.
Yeah, I mean,
especially
they'd have to prove that they stole these documents. They'd have to prove that they busted into this party.
Yeah.
It seems like if you don't say that and you don't ever let anybody know that and you just say, okay, here are the people we need to follow to collect evidence.
Yeah.
Here's some of the leads we can follow up on. But
the case, like, I think this is something like in Rainmaker where, like, if you have evidence that you personally have acquired illegally because you broke a contract or you broke and entered or you went into an unauthorized location, but you take that evidence and turn it over to the police can still act on that evidence as if they got it lawfully.
I have no idea.
That seems like a massive loophole.
Yeah.
Because you could just have a guy like
Ray. Hire your independent contractors.
They had nothing to do with it. Just wind it up on my desk one day. Yep. I don't know. I know we have lots of real lawyers listening to this that they can help us out.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of how I think things are kind of going.
All right.
Speaking of that murder cabin, what do you think about the blood contaminated gonorrhea? That's the second time gonorrhea has been mentioned.
How was it mentioned in the first reference?
Casper tested positive for gonorrhea. So are we supposed to believe that someone else died in the snuff house with the crow's mask and all that, and actually Casper was the one tortured to death in this murder shack?
No, it can't be, because they said it was female. Female blood with gonorrhea. So it's impossible that it was Casper.
Yeah. But also, didn't they make a big deal about the fact that these girls were all tested to be clean? Like, you know, you're having a big rich and powerful stag party.
You would think.
With a bunch of clean girls. I mean, if you're going to surgically enhance them to be tins, you might as well make sure that they don't have a disease, because God forbid these guys wear fucking condoms. That's not Eyes Wide Shut.
I doubt there was any safe sex practiced at these parties. doesn't strike me as correct.
Yeah, no, But there's something. I mean, you mentioned gonorrhea out of the blue, two separate episodes. I feel like that's some kind of connection. I don't know what. Did Casper have someone important to? Is that Casper's assistant that was replaced? And I mean, the timeline kind of matches up. If that went down,
right, there's something there.
If that goes down in the September 9th, I think the previous
stag party.
And that his assistant, which was in like the week before Halloween, said that she'd been on the job for 6 weeks. That kind of all tracks together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe.
Well, I mean, maybe the crow actually didn't kill Casper at all. They just found the body and then staged it so it would be discovered, because maybe the crow and Casper were working together to bring this whole thing down. Now, that doesn't match up with what we know about Casper,
kind of
being
like
a womanizer and using women and being like, in, you know,
and trying to get in on this deal. And
he's got the diamonds.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff to still I don't have a real good handle on.
Yeah, the diamonds are interesting. We'll talk about those, I'm sure, in more detail in a minute. But I don't know where you want to go from here, because there's a lot of other stuff I want to talk about, just of my feelings on certain scenes and stuff.
Okay.
Because
I have one other point I wanted to clean up about. What did you think about the Ray versus Frank showdown, just from a performance standpoint?
I thought, you know, I went into this, like I've said before, not liking Vince Vaughn.
Uh-huh.
Man, I've changed my mind. Jesus, I thought he was so good in this episode.
I feel like the big mistake they did is have him so many scenes of him sweating small stake stuff, like going around and leaning on apartment managers and construction guys. And now we see him actually doing some awesome stuff, and it feels right. Maybe it was just goofy to see this guy going so over the top, dealing with, like, you know, middle class, non-criminal people.
Yeah, a bunch of blue collar guys.
You see him driving nails into dude's shoulders and going toe to toe with Ray.
And it's not just that too, right? It's like, so you look at the scene with Stan's family, and that's another scene that really blew me away, is how he handled this kid. It's kind of what we love about gangsters, right? Like, they're these bad guys, but in the end, they'll always, like, take care of the families of the people who are hurt by their actions.
Yeah, they'll try to make up for it. It's the Godfather romanticism.
Yeah, that, like, absolutely.
They only hurt people that deserve to be hurt.
Yeah, and then they take care of their families. Yeah. They're good to their communities, all this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of the part that makes everything else okay
in
our minds. And I feel like, man, he pulls this off when he's talking to this kid, because there's a lot of Frank in this conversation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff that he's saying about this kid's father and how, like, there are splits in your life and you can take those and you can put them to good use.
Yeah.
I felt like
destroy you,
that totally resonates with what we know about Frank's childhood.
Yeah.
And he says he's got about five of those at this point, which, I could see that.
When I was watching this, I thought I ate it up.
Yeah.
And it was in stark contrast to complete lack of chemistry that Ray and Chad have, which might be the point. I want to talk about that next. But it made me think, as like, you know, I ought to take and, like, make a supercut of, like, an hour's worth of inspiring father-son speeches. Like, you get the speech from Rocky Balboa, you get this, you throw in Christopher Walken from Pulp Fiction as a, you know, as the break the tension. Like, would that be cool? Like, if you would record that for, like, your son in case something happened to you? Like, it's like, in case, like, you know, play, yeah, when you're 21, play this. And this is everything I wanted to say, only done well, way better.
So is it going
to
be you reenacting those scenes? Or is it going to be...
That's even better. No, I was going to do just the takes, just the raw takes of stuff
I think
like
you
that.
Should reenact them. You should dress up like the characters.
All right.
And reenact them.
Right.
And put it on VHS.
So I'm a sucker for father-son relationships. It's like, it's my favorite thing about The Walking Dead. It's one of the big reasons I keep watching the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's something compelling there about Rick and Carl. Coral. And I like Frank's quest, because he seems like he could be a good dad. And he certainly was a good father figure here. It seems like it gave the kids some comfort and closure. But Ray and his son have nothing.
Yeah.
And Chad is... just this nothing character. He's got nothing, like, and I don't know what to do with it, because I think that's part of the point. He's super uncomfortable around Ray. Ray called him, you know, it's like that really terrible scene where he bullies him and calls him a fat pussy and all this stuff. And and he's not clearly into the things his dad wants him to be in. There's, like, the chemistry's, what little chemistry they might have is off by the court reporter there. But, like, I just was like, yes, just cut this kid loose. Get out of here. You're not doing any good. And I don't – am I supposed to feel that way? Because I kind of – I don't mind Chad being some, you know, fat redheaded kid that's not like his dad in any way. But he should be engaging somewhat.
I feel like maybe you're blaming the kid a little bit more than you should be.
I'm not
blaming –
no.
The show's telling you to.
I think he's doing what he's supposed to do. And what I'm saying is, like, if I'm supposed to care about the relationship, I should have – I mean, the Ray's relationship with him feels fundamentally selfish and more about his own pride as a man than really paternal. Like, when he says, I love you to Chad, I don't buy it.
Oh, no, no, you're totally right about that part. I just don't think that Chad should be blamed for any of that, right? Like, Chad's reaction to his father is exactly that. It's a reaction to
his
father.
That's what I'm saying. Am I supposed to be feeling this way, that, like, Ray just needs to get the fuck out?
I don't think anybody is thinking that Ray is a good influence on his kid.
But I've also felt simultaneously, like, our principal point of engagement is, can Ray redeem himself? And one of the ways he can redeem himself is to be a good father to this kid. Whereas, like, I feel like that ship has sailed a long time ago.
It has, yeah.
And he just needs to get out and, you know, doesn't even make, you know, any kind of conditions on it. Just needs to get out of the kid's life.
Yeah, no, you're right.
And that's a weird thing for me to feel both of those things simultaneously. Like, the kid can not, again, he doesn't have to be like his dad. He can be a pacifist, and he can, but make him interesting. Like, would I want to have a conversation with this kid?
No. No, certainly not. And maybe it would help us a lot to see a scene of him with his mother.
Or see him really alive with his stepfather.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, like, something.
Like, see how he interacts with people who aren't hurting him at every turn, you know? And who he's less closed off to.
Right. Yeah, no, that would have been very helpful.
Yeah. I got to say, though, I do kind of feel for Ray in this scene, because that's the most awkward situation ever.
It's terrible. Like,
I'm going to sit here with arms folded and a notepad in my hand waiting for you to fuck up so I can take your kid away. Now have fun.
Yeah.
Now interact normally.
I feel like that he was worried about the wrong things. Like, I mean,
sure.
These observers are looking for, like, gross abuse. They're not, like, writing down guys awkward about the debate about whether instruments of death are appropriate bonding activities. Father talks shit about Friends, the beloved sitcom. Like, I don't think any of that stuff is actionable. He was just freaking out about it because he was realizing, I have no relationship with this child, and I'm trying to go to the mat for this relationship that I don't have. Maybe maybe they did, but I get the idea that poor Chad has just been subjected to this bullshit out of his sense of guilt over what all happened between him and his mom.
Well, that's like, they're sure as shit writing down when he says, "Oh, I guess not." When he says, "Do you care if you see me, or do you want to see me again?"
Yeah,
or whatever he says. He responds with, "I guess not," as if, like, okay, sure, I'll see you again if I need to.
But there again, I mean, you could chalk that up to being awkward having a stranger there. Like, I feel like that these social workers are not complete idiots, I guess.
They understand the situation, But at the same time, like, kids don't react in the same way. Like,
well, Ray trying to engage her repeatedly, I mean, this is his – he seems like his own worst problem. Like, if you want to win an argument with a judge, you don't do it by telling him he's a dumb fuck. Not looking at the right things. If you're trying to impress a social worker, you obey their, at the minimum, obey their directions to pretend like they're not there, which I get is hard.
But I mean, if I'm the social worker, I'm looking more at the kid, right? Because the kid's going to give the more honest reactions to stuff,
I guess. And also,
at 11, you can start to say, oh, maybe this kid is going to put on appearances, but certainly not as much as Frank is. Or, I'm sorry, Ray is.
Yeah, I just feel like Ray was freaking out because he, he was having his emperor has no clothes moment. I have no relationship with my son.
No, he was realizing it in that moment. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
He thought he had something that he didn't, and now, I mean, that's why he goes on this bender, essentially, right?
Yeah,
he's realizing, oh my god, I don't have any chance with this kid. I don't have a relationship, and that's why he calls up his wife and comes to that realization that he's just going to let him go. I think this is the episode where it turns and he says, I'm no good for this kid and he's going to be much happier without me.
Yeah.
I thought, frankly, that he was going to commit suicide.
He might have tried. Like, the amount, I cannot, I mean, I'm not familiar with any of the drugs that have been used in this episode outside of alcohol, which I'm fairly familiar with.
You've heard of them, just not used them.
But I still understand the quantity of cocaine that this man was doing in conjunction with the quantities of booze that he was ingesting was kind of suicidal.
Seems like it.
Like, and he even was like clutching his chest at one point, like, oh, this might be the big one. Elizabeth, I'm coming home. He might have had that in his mind. Like, maybe that was his crucible. Like, if I can get through this night without dying, and I'm going to take everything that I've ever gotten out of the, I'm going to go raid my medicine cabinet from my car. I'm going to take everything I've stolen out of the evidence room. I'm going to do it all.
Yep.
I'm going to smash all the models. If I survive, then that means I get to escape with my own soul or my own life. I don't know. I'm always, that's just not how I interact with the world. Like, when I engage in really painful stimulus, I don't fucking go and drink myself into a stupor.
It's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, I understand that people do, and that a guy like Ray would, but every time I see, I'm like, Jesus, this is a big mistake.
It's only
this is a
worse
way to compound your problems, man.
For sure. Can I just say I really like the direction in this episode way more than previous ones?
Miguel Sapochnik, man. The guy that
he knocked it out of the park. I mean, shots as simple as, like, the scene where, you know, they find out about El Monte and they're walking in the street to this house is just so well done. Like, it probably helps to have that music behind it. And I was watching this thing and I'm thinking like, man, this is a lot like Drive as far as tone goes.
You're right.
Like
Which
that kind of
that was a very stylish
noir sort of thing.
Yeah.
I
didn't care for that film, but it was stylish as hell.
Yeah. Well,
not a bad direction to ape as far as.
Yeah, and it was moody, and it was kind of stylistically similar.
Yeah, but like that shot, and then again, like a Frank walking into that abandoned, warehouse, white warehouse where he was going to torture the guy,
or the construction site, or whatever that is, the quarry,
and the actual action shot of their heist was really good. And this is the guy, you know, we had never heard of him before until he directed. Well, we knew I'd never heard of him, but he directed Repo Men, which I've seen that. Yeah. And he also directed Hard Home on this year's Game of Thrones, which we just fucking couldn't believe how well done that was. Mm-hmm. This guy is like the masculine Michelle McLaren. I mean, he's really getting a reputation with me anyway for doing really well done, seamless action.
Yeah. And I think, you know, he also does some quiet moments pretty well.
That's true. It's so, not.
It felt very intimidating the way that was shot.
It's almost damning them with faint praise to be like, oh, they do action so well because they do everything. They're like they have all the tools in the tool set. Yeah. I feel like action might be some of the hardest stuff to shoot.
It's the most showy.
It's definitely technically. I mean, thinking about all those cuts and like where the camera's going to be and coordinating the stunt work. And
how do we show that he's not actually hitting him?
Yeah, whereas directing the quiet moments is all about your relationship with the actors and getting that emotion out of them, which is, that's a different type of magic, I guess. But yeah, he's really good. I'm going to be officially excited about any episode that he's attached to.
Yeah, no.
I wish Breaking Bad was still around so he could take a poke at that. Uh-huh. Maybe
Better Call Saul.
Better Call Saul.
There you go.
There you go. to get the Villa Gang. I gotta slip them a note for their production.
Yeah. Going back real quick to Ray and his kid. Do you think Ray makes the right decision here? Like I know.
Yes. I don't know what decision you're referring to, but yes,
the decision to call off the court case and just say, I'll give you all the custody rights.
I think so.
I think so, too.
From the evidence I have in front of.
But I guess what I'm really getting at is this idea that his wife won't tell his kid that he's not actually his father. What do you think about that decision?
Well, I don't think that's something you can hold someone to.
A, I don't think she meant it, and I don't think that he believed she meant it either. He wanted to hear it.
Well, I don't know. I feel like that there was one line that screams significance, and I don't really want to talk about it because I don't have any evidence. But when she says, I need to do this for myself, mm-hmm. I don't know what that means. Like, would it be a relief to find out that her child was actually the rapist and not Ray's? Like, what? I mean, I don't know what it's like to be a woman in that situation and what kind of closure that would give you.
Sure.
But I thought that was a significant line and that might actually somehow speak to the actual identity of the rapist and whether that's significant and whether Ray got the right guy and whether he's actually the guy's father. There was something to that, and I don't have it. But no, I think Ray, from what I see, that Ray exiting this kid's life is going to be a huge relief.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at it from like the angle of so A, I think part of the reason I thought that Ray was potentially going to commit suicide here after this phone call is because of the way he just wants to hear that she's going to tell the kid that. He doesn't even need to believe it. He just wants to hear it. And I felt like that was kind of his swan song. He's just going to go out on that note.
See, I think committing suicide would be a dick move. Like now, if you die in some kind of heroic, that's probably the best case scenario. As far as him and his kid's relationship is if he can somehow die heroically so that, you know, as a kid grows up, he's like, I didn't understand my old man and he was weird and he was violent. But, you know, it's kind of like Russ said, sometimes you need bad men at the door to keep the other bad men out. You can have a sense of quiet pride in that part of that stock is in me. I mean, there's like kind of things you can work with, but if your dad just blows his head off after he has this tearful conversation with your mother about promise, you'll never reveal that you're the that just feels like, what do you do with that as a child?
Yeah. But on the other hand, like if your mother tells you, oh yeah, I was raped and you're a product of that rape, my God.
I think if she's anywhere close to telling him about that part of his history, that that's a bad decision. That's
maybe wait a while.
And then maybe never.
Yeah.
Like
that's I'm kind of with you there. I think this kid is already messed up enough by his father. Whether or not this is real father, if he found out something like that, it would just crush him.
Yeah. No, it's like, you know, what, Jesus Christ, what, you know, there's something bad wrong with me. My father can't love me. He's not my real father. I'm the product of this violation of my mother. Yeah, that's, I don't know how old. I don't think it's kind to tell a kid that ever.
Yeah, you might be right.
I mean, maybe there's circumstances, but Jesus, that's like.
And maybe Ray understands that, and that's why he's asking.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But then again, I don't know. There's like two ways to look at the whole, like, do you tell a kid if they're adopted or not? When do you tell them? Like,
adoption is one thing. Product of rape is.
But I'm saying, like, there seems like I shouldn't pretend that I have enough information about this to say what is good or bad or what a kid would want. And if a kid says he wants to know,
Yeah.
Sometimes having information that you want is not necessarily the best thing for you.
Annie goes undercover as her sister to get into the sex party. Once inside, she finds Vera. Waiting outside his backup, Ray and Paul stumble onto Osip and McCandless, signing some documents, which they steal. Things go sideways for Annie. She's forced to kill one of Osip's men to get Vera and herself out of the party. Okay, let's talk about the end of this episode.
How fucked is Athena right now?
Super fucked! As far as everybody who's concerned knows, she just went into this party and killed a man and ran off with Vera.
And we said, like, well, there's no way, how do you prove, but one simple way is you lock the place down, you see who's still there, who you've checked in, whose purses you've got, whose cell phones you've got. Now, mm-hmm. I'm sure that she's smart enough to use a burner and fake ID and all that kind of stuff. But still, who's missing? Athena.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone knows who Athena, like, you know, Blake, it's either going to tie back to Annie. Mm-hmm. Or more likely, they're going to be looking for Athena, who is a known person, a known quantity, and she's going to be murdered.
They know who these people are, right?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I think Annie probably used fake IDs and all that, but
she would have to use the ID of her sister in order to get in under that ID.
I guess. I was just thinking more that it could just be bullshit IDs, but Blake's going to know that it was Athena. And
at the very least, it's got her picture on it, right?
Because she's already someone that he knew because he mentioned Athena. You're older than, like, that's the kind of thing that makes you stand out in a crowd. Like, something, you've got a certain look about you, which is true. Rachel McAdams is something else. But also you're old. I mean, there's a bunch of things why he would remember what she looked like.
Yeah.
And then you try to track down the real Athena. No, I feel like that's going to be one of the big things, that Annie is going to get her sister really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what she does with that. I don't know how she deals with that.
I don't know.
After she spent this whole episode. I mean, that's the other thing with Annie. This is now her third raid that she's gone in and fucked up in some way. Or gone off half-cocked. She didn't have accurate information on the Camhor operation. I don't think we need to talk about the shootout that ended up with countless civilian deaths and police deaths. That was a half-cocked operation. And this is the whole time everyone's saying, this is a really bad idea. Mm-hmm. What's your plan when you don't have a knife? Well, I'll figure it out. What's your plan when people demand easies? Oh, I'll just figure it out. Are you really sure you want to do this? I can handle myself. Like, this pig-headedness is going to end up costing her sister something. And
it's
I don't
got
know.
To.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't say that she didn't see it coming, too.
Yeah, no. I mean, everybody saw it coming, right? Last episode we were talking about
except
this.
Except Annie.
You know, she's pushing her sister back into this world, at the very least, when she's just about to get out, Godfather style.
Did you think it was a little too heavy-handed? Their sister gives her a portrait of a woman drowning on dry land in the exact episode that Annie almost gets strangled to death?
I hadn't even thought about it. But really? I guess so. Yeah.
Okay. Because the second I didn't get in for the second watch, I'm like, oh, I see what they did there.
Yeah, I view that more as a metaphorical thing, not like this literally tied to...
I guess it could just be foreshadowing, too, which I don't know why it made me roll my eyes a little bit, but...
Yeah, I don't know. This scene really, really worked for me.
Which scene are we talking about?
The house scene, the party scene.
Okay.
The orgy scene. From Annie's predicament, regardless of how she got into this whole predicament and whether or not she should have been there in the first place, once sure. she's in, you feel... I'm on the edge of my seat going, this woman is in serious danger here.
Yeah, when they spray that shit in her mouth and she started tripping and then having hallucinations of her past, I'm like, oh, this is really bad. Like, thank God they have a transponder because without that, I don't know how they get her out of there.
Yeah, I mean, they're kind of following her around the perimeter of the house.
And that seemed to be the plan, that she was going to go be the primary infiltration and see what she can find out. Mm-hmm. While these guys are going to infiltrate primarily to make sure that she's got a path of exit and they yes. can help her out, but as a secondary objective to see what they can uncover too. Pretty yeah. convenient that they happened upon Osip and the Catalyst guy having a very important discussion about their business sure. dealings.
And it's super convenient that she found Vera inside. Like, yeah, a lot of
are
convenience.
Are you surprised Vera showed up? As that she's been some kind of like drugged out permanent sex slave to this cult, this I don't know. Cult.
I honestly thought she was probably dead.
I did too,
but obviously not.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't. How does that fit in with the idea that oh they're hiring these $2,000 hookers?
Plus, like she all the was time. Acting like her and Annie were having completely different opposite reaction to these drugs that the other women were having. It seemed like, yeah. you know what I mean? Like, they were, like, really having a hard time and a bad trip. And the other girls, it seemed like they were describing it as if this makes the thing, if not bearable, then more fun. Now, there was a lot of shot at dead-eyed hookers.
Sure.
You know, because...
Maybe you hit on it. Maybe it's just a bad trip, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it kind of depends on your headspace when you go into those things, whether or not you'll have a good or bad trip.
I have no idea what Molly is. Like,
I've never done Molly.
It's a hallucinogen or...
I don't know.
I've ever...
But I do know that the concept of a bad trip is a real thing.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And it's largely dependent on...
Set and setting.
How you're going into it.
That's not a good set. Not a good setting.
So if these other women are like, shit, I'm making $2,000 a night for this thing. Yeah, I'll go in and bang a few guys.
Yeah.
I don't care. And they're having a good time. Maybe their trips are different.
Yeah.
Because the other ones were actual hookers. I mean, they're there for yes. a purpose. And they know what they're there for.
But there's some... But
whereas Vera looked like she was forced into this whole thing.
Yeah,
Annie
I don't know how to square the circle between this being human trafficking, which implies like everything kind of against these women got bamboozled with... Some of them seem like really excited to be there. And the women yeah. that Chisani was parading to from, you know, picked them up from Pit Lore and dropped them off to Osip, they seemed like they were like, oh, yeah, this is like this wonderful experience for me. I don't know. I feel like that metaphor is all mixed up.
Well, it's all fine until you end up in the murder shack.
Well, maybe. It seems like Vera's having a bad time anyway. But
yeah, she's definitely forced into the situation she's in.
I was kind of surprised at how tame the party was.
Tame?
Like, I mean, thought
is this
there was
a Saturday night for you?
Please. A Thursday night.
Oh, okay.
No. With the murder shack and the sex swings and the masks and the weird stuff, I was expecting a minimum Eyes Wide Shut levels of what the fuck.
Okay.
If not some more kind of unconventional BDSM fetish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe some people doing, there's like a lack of consent involved. I don't know, but it seemed like
an orgy is a
this seemed like
itself.
Just a giant rich person orgy, which I yeah. kind of believe this shit happens. Like
well, probably.
Yeah.
Probably so.
Like this is like Hollywood from the 40s and 50s, right? This is just, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess
this is Rat Pack shit. Everybody's wearing tuxes and they're jacking off and they're banging broads three at a time and everybody's having a good time.
Sure. I'm not sure necessarily what I expected beyond an orgy. You're probably right. I did expect at least some masks.
Some kind of culty thing.
Yeah.
A statue of Moloch. Would that have killed him? Kind of get a concrete owl? Kind of get an altar?
That's
can somebody
an,
be
another
strapped
mile
to an altar?
Back in the woods.
It's, yeah. Can there be some robes?
I mean,
some
this,
robes and some chanting?
This is the entrance to the party. This is not the party, right?
That's
There's
true.
Another party going on, and it's not happening in this house.
That's true. Like, where is the basement? What's going on the top floor?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah, you might. But no, I was little with HBO. I was kind of like this. I don't know what, again, what I was expecting, but kind of like Eyes Wide Shut or worse. Okay. Some Caligula.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is some McDowell levels of depravity going here. what else we want to talk about? What? Some people were talking shit about the music. I don't get that at all. Like
talking shit about it? Like
yeah, like they were saying
it's not good?
Yeah.
I loved it.
I love the fusion of like the classic kind of 60s era heist.
Yeah, some saxophones.
Yeah, with the throbbing synth track of Doom. Those are two great tastes that taste great together, and I felt like it very well fit the scene.
I think so. I feel like it's a modern twist on the noir style.
Yes, yes, exactly.
And I'm happy to see that.
I thought that worked, but I noticed a lot of people saying, what's up with the music? I don't like the music. And again, like, that's completely subjective opinion. I'm not hating on you, but I did not share it at all.
The other thing about this party is, I don't think there are going to be future parties at this place.
No.
It seems foolish.
The Chandelier Ranch needs to be shut down. Because... Yeah.
And I'm frankly surprised that they left the murder shack as murdery as it is, right? Like, cover your tracks a little better.
Well, you know,
clean up the blood. Maybe take the tape off the chair.
Yeah. Or burn the fucking shack down.
Every time. Yeah. And then build a new one.
It helped me a little bit because I thought that was like, in this place's backyard, like it was on the grounds. Like it was like the shed.
I thought so too,
but they mentioned it being like 2.5 miles away.
Yeah, it's back
there. And it's not on the same property. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, that's...
But it's not going to happen again. And I wonder if maybe they burned some of the evidence they could have gotten by just having this thing blow up.
They still got Paul with like 3 binders full of it. I mean...
Yeah. Yeah. They pulled out evidence. I just wonder if they had been a little more sly about the whole thing, if they could have gathered evidence over a longer period of time and figured out more. I don't know.
What else do we want to talk about on the... Because the other thing I want to talk about is Frank's other half of the story, where he goes into full investigation, interrogation mode. We got to find out why his assistant's called Nails. Mm-hmm. Creative interrogation scene. Which led to the place in El Monte, which led to the actual Mexican standoff with real Mexicans. Did that work for you? Was that funny? I thought it was kind of funny.
I didn't think it was funny.
As a wry, ice-breaking observation between gangsters.
The funniest thing I think that happened in this episode is when Frank and Ray are talking and he's about to walk out and Frank's like, you might be the only friend I got. And Ray's like, wouldn't that be fucked up?
Yeah.
I chuckled at that, but no, I didn't think the Mexican standoff was particularly funny.
I want to read an email from Matthew S.
Okay.
He goes, I thought this was a great episode, but I couldn't help chuckling at Frank's David Brent-esque negotiation style.
Oh,
one,
Jesus.
Step one, make racist joke during 10 standoffs. Step two, tell your opponent exactly what you want. Mm-hmm. Step three, make overly generous opening offer. Step four, reveal remaining information under minimal questioning. Step five, offer unsolicited increase to previous overly generous offer. Step six, immediately accept the first counterproposal. Step seven, ensure the deal is in no way constrained by any explicit or implied conditions. Step eight, wait by the phone. Step nine, sound as desperate as humanly possible during the resultant meeting. Step 10, profit. And he says, how did Casper only get $5 million out of this guy? I think it's because that's all the money he had.
Yeah, see, he could have gotten
but
more.
But when analyzed that, that was what was bugging me watching this scene is like, Jesus, Frank, what are you doing?
Like, here's what you got to remember, though. If this works and Frank gets his hard drive, he's out. It doesn't matter if he gives away all of his clubs and all of his poker houses and everything. He's trying to get this $5 million land deal back in place. And if he can do that, he doesn't care about his underworld operation.
You kind of still got to care about pissing off the Mexican cartel.
But he can just sell the club and say, oh, by the way, there's a deal with this. And if he gets $50 for the club, what does he care?
Yeah, that's a good point. But on the other hand, it is a very glaring sign of weakness. You kind of have to play the game. Because if the other guy knows that you're all out...
He made him an offer they couldn't refuse.
Yeah.
In a different way.
I feel like if he just played the game... I'm with Matt. If he just kept his cards a little closer to his vest and played the game out so these guys didn't know exactly how big a boner he had for this information, things might have gone differently. Now, having said that, this seems very rules lawyery. Hey, we said you'd meet face to face. I didn't say anything about the blood being blood left in her body. And now we'll take the, it's like.
Here's your face. Here's her face.
So Frank's going to have a gun battle with these guys, right?
Probably, yeah. Here's the thing that I didn't like, I guess. And the thing that doesn't make sense about that is the way he handled Rey felt like a powerful man handling a serious problem that he's got.
Yes.
He didn't back down. He didn't like acquiesce to Rey and say, oh, he's got a gun on me, so I'll be nice to him. He pointed out like all the flaws and in Rey's personality and all this stuff. And it felt like he was in control. Whereas, yeah, in this negotiation, it did not feel like he was in control.
Yeah, well, I mean, there again, he's dealing, like, Rey has got a functional system. I mean, it's a fucked up system of morality and justice, but he has a functional code. Whereas the Cisco kid is cleaning off the blood that he just slit this girl's throat that's one of their people for essentially shits and grins. You know, because Frank would give them, like...
I kind of like the reasoning they gave.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because she talks...
Because it's kind of like...
She admitted to talking to cops.
Everybody knows that's not really the reason that they did it, but it is also a plausible reason to do it.
Yeah, I guess. Snitches get all the blood drained out of their body.
that's how the saying goes.
That's how it goes, yeah, sure. one other thing I want to talk about is Frank's interrogation of this guy who had the connection to Arena Rufo.
Okay.
He says, you're Santa Muerte, which... I'm not aware of being an actual official religious practice or he's like the guy.
That's what
like,
that guy says.
Like, it's not a gang. It's not like that, which I liked his friends. Like, whatever the fuck. It's a book club.
Sure.
That's a pretty good line.
Yeah.
But this is a big thing that's been part of the series since episode one. This whole, I mean, Casper had a Santa Muerta shrine set up in his sex apartment.
Yeah. But in his home.
That's what I'm saying. Like his sex home. Like everything is a snuff house. It's a sex home. It's a fuck cabin. It's a murder shack. Everything's got some kind of hyphenated, terrible thing attached to it. But yeah, it's not like that, but it's like something.
Yes, there is something to Santa Muerta. It is a group. It is a group of people.
And the other thing
how they're affiliated.
We also know that Nick takes things that are kind of real life, like, you know, increasingly obvious Bohemian Grove, the, you know, Blackwater security consulting group, the real life city of Vernon, and then he puts a spin on it. So if he takes the real life kind of, you know, sainthood of this Muerte character and kind of the, not exactly cult, but the following that has around it, is he going to spin that into another cult? And is Casper and his fingers and everyone? He's out of fingers. How many pies has he got at this point? He's like an octopus with this pie finger bullshit.
You're absolutely right.
He's like, you got a movie you got a movie pie? Give me a finger in there. You got a real estate pie? Yeah, you got a diamond pie, sex pie. I got him, you know. He's Jack Horner with 10 thumbs.
You're right.
All of them with plums on them.
I don't know how Santa Muerte is going to connect, but you're right. There have been two very obvious references to it, so...
It's been a while since we had one. Like it's like I don't think we've had one since we saw the shrine again in episode two. So this seems very significant.
So we know that the club that the club that Frank muscles back in on had an arrangement with this Cisco kid and the guy who's running the operation.
Is this Cisco kid and the other guy, the not Cisco kid? The less ridiculous dressed one.
The guy with the vest.
Were they attached to Nodos and this other guy? Or were they just kind of in their territory? Were they low level?
I think they got to be attached because they know about each other, right? Like this Santa Muerte guy knows where El Monte is and
was El Monte set up?
Because
I thought it was also kind of weird that he happened to come along at their, you know, lair where they're all gone and then they come in force. Like, I feel like this was a bit of a setup. The nail guy was a bit of a setup operation.
If so, then Frank's a bit of a sucker, yeah? Because he just got thrown into an ambush there.
Well, I mean, yeah, they played him for a fool.
Uh-huh.
Like, you know, the flaw with you saying, with him, like you suggest saying, I'll give you my clubs. I don't give a shit about anything but this woman. That's signaling to them that I am weak and also I need this thing so I can no longer be weak. So if you deny me that, you can get everything you want and give me nothing. Like, I don't know. Just is a massively underplaying of his hand.
Yeah, he's a desperate man.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, like you said, you don't do anything because you're hungry, not even eat.
You shouldn't. You're right, but sometimes you
he's
do.
He's going back on his episode one advice, damn it.
I know. It's the shame of it.
So I got some feedback that's in the psychosphere. Danny H. says, the young brother and sister shown in the picture are obviously going to be the killers in the mask, or at least one of them. The question is, are they people that we've met before? Now, I don't know that I agree that they're obviously the killers, mm-hmm. but this is he's touching on two kind of very popular theories here, so we'll let him run with it. And, of course, he's talking about the brother and sister that were part of the jewelry heist. They survived the horrifying account of them surviving in a cabinet for days with their dead parents. They're rotting there in the heat of the LA riots. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking it's Mayor Chisani's son and daughter. We've already established that speaking of the daughter, Andrea from Breaking Bad, is up to something. And we know that he is a good actor who changes personality to suit whatever is required of him. Also, Nick has been following a similar pattern in season one, where both of these characters first appeared in episode 3, which is when Errol Childress first appeared in season 1. They're also the same age, late 20s to early 30s, like the kids would be in the picture. What if they are adopted by the mayor after the shootout? This would tie in with the adoption infertility theme of the season, especially if the creepy plastic surgeon made Mayor Chisani's wife infertile somehow, which, of course, is speculation. Mm-hmm. It seems like Nick Pizzolatto could have been laying the seeds for this twist all season. What if they'd just been getting revenge on their parents' murder? This also could tie in the police shells used on Ray. The murders took place during the LA riots, which is something the police use, the riot shells. Ray's dad, many of the police force we've met, or even a 20-year-old upstart criminal Frank could be implicated in a robbery / murder of these kids' parents. I'm not sure how young you have to be to join the police, but could a 20-year-old Ray have been in the riots? That's an interesting question. Like, I feel like we're trying to make too many connections at this point, but mm-hmm. the riots were in 92. Colin Farrell is almost 40, so if he's playing that on the show, then he'd be only 18 during the riots, and I don't think you have to have a college degree to get into any police force, right?
I have no idea.
So, like, 22-ish is, the youngest he could be to be a cadet. Now, maybe he's 45. Maybe it is possible. Certainly, when his dad starts talking about the riots and he's not volunteering information like he had anything to do with that stuff. So, and also, let's take these theories one at a time. Do we like the theory that these kids are the mayor's kids?
No, I don't like that theory.
I don't like it either. Why don't you like it?
I think the biggest, most obvious thing is their names are not the same.
He could have changed the names.
He could have. Why would he do that?
I don't know.
Like, these kids are old enough to identify, like, certainly the boy understands, like, this is my name.
Yeah.
And the girl's 4 years old. She understands it. She knows that.
Yeah.
Like, suddenly you're calling me a different name?
What? Yeah.
I'm not going to like that. I don't know.
And also,
I think the names are the biggest problem.
And they've always talked about their mom and their dad as if that's just a real thing. Like, you know, I feel like that it would have come up in conversation with Annie if her mother wasn't their real mom, or especially their dad, who they describe as a monster, is not the real dad. Mm-hmm. Like, it would surprise me that they don't acknowledge that at all. But I got to say, the picture, you could age them up and see the brother and sister.
Yeah.
And you're right, the name's a problem. The way the family dynamic doesn't really fit, but it wouldn't surprise me if Nick is, you know, kind of jockeying for that position. Also, that would help kind of tie some of these plots together. Mm. Do you like the idea of the kids being either affiliated with the Raven, or one of them the Raven themselves, or both of them are the Raven, getting revenge against corrupt cops and corrupt institutions that they blame, you know, that they blame on their parents' death?
Could be. I don't have a huge problem with that.
There's another Reddit theory where, you know, because it seems that they hinted pretty strongly that the police were involved in this diamond heist. They talked about it being very tactical, you know, like a SWAT team, and it happened at the time of the riots. Like, this is some kind of shield, the shield kind of extra legal hit squad that might have seen this as an opportunity to line their pockets.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's pretty strong.
Yeah, I definitely got that impression. I'm just not sure. I don't feel like we have enough information yet to know for sure how the diamonds connect.
Arena mentioned a skinny, tall white cop.
Yeah.
Asking her questions. That's pretty obviously the lieutenant, right?
I think so.
Does that help or hurt the theory that he's involved with the Raven?
I think it helps it.
Does it really? Because I feel like the Raven is against corruption, and this guy seems to be working. He's pro. I thought it was up in the air that seems like it's pro corruption. He's trying to cover up.
I don't buy that it's anti corruption that the Raven's after here.
Staging.
I still don't buy it.
What do you think the point is then? If you're staging that body to shine a light on Catalyst, I mean, you were on that from the beginning. Why are you off it?
No, I wasn't on that from the beginning. I've always said it could be someone on the inside of this deal who feels like they're getting screwed by Casper.
So it's a greed thing, not a noble Robin Hood Batman kind of thing.
It could be someone within the operation. It could be one of these kids.
Pretty fucking operatic if you're not trying to make a social point. Like, why the masks? Why all the theater? I mean, if you're just wanting to get revenge, it feels like you roll in with your muscle and you settle with the guns.
I mean, I'm just not convinced that that's not the case yet. Like, everybody seems to be totally on board with this idea that it's a revenge killings. I'm not totally on board with that yet.
All right. Got another email from a Sarah HL who has a degree in literature and theater.
Okay.
And she says that there's a lot of interesting, you know, we talked in the early episodes about the commonalities that these characters and settings have with some of the Greek tragedies, mm-hmm. like Oedipus.
Yeah.
She says one of the major elements of Greek tragedies is the tragic hero's flaw, which is typically hubris. There's usually some sort of reversal of fortune as well as an antagonist, realization. Actually, I pronounced that wrong. Anagnorisis?
What?
Which is the term for a realization of something crucial, usually their tragic flaw, but at a time when it is far too late. For example, in Creon, who is the king in the play Antigone, sentences Antigone to death for giving her brother, the traitor, a proper burial. He realizes once he walls her into the cave that he should not have done this, and that isn't the way justice should be carried out. However, when he unearths her, he finds out that she's hanging herself to spare herself that fate. Antigone, too, arguably suffers from hubris, which is what led her to being confined in the cave in the first place. She continues, I don't know, because we talked about that in this episode 1 and 2, that particular part of Oedipus. God, I don't know why I can't say that right. Mythology. I don't know what the tragic hero is supposed to be in the season or even if there is one, but I do find the other elements of Greek tragedy that I previously mentioned seem particularly prevalent, especially the stuff about hubris. So many characters suffer from excessive pride. I want to talk about the main cast in terms of hubris and whether if this is, and I think that there's a lot of information saying that this is kind of a Greek tragedy from a 10,000 foot view. Mm-hmm. Like even when Frank was meeting, I forget who it was, outside a particular club, there was prominent Greek architecture and like, you know, pottery motifs around like the characters' names, all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paul, does he seem like he suffers from excessive hubris?
Not at all. No.
I don't either. If anything, he's like a self-loather.
Yeah. I don't think he has much self-confidence at all. Except where maybe in the area that he's most competent, which is the military tactics, I guess.
But even then, he's kind of fucked up about it because he's like, you know, has a near panic attack when he's trying to explain that it's just following orders and like his prowess doesn't seem to be used in something he's particularly proud of.
Yeah, I mean, when they do the heist thing, he's like, if you need me, I will come in there and get you.
Sure.
Like, he's very competent.
And he's a bad. He likes
he's
spider
confident
monkey choke
and he knows
guy.
He can do sure. certain shit. But yeah. That doesn't strike me as the same type of hubris as we're looking for.
No, it's not a tragic flaw to be too proud of how good you are killing dudes.
When you're actually a badass, yeah.
Ray.
Nope.
Even though I didn't, because we kind of briefly game planned this out before we actually got on the mics, and I was with you, but then I just remembered hearing myself say about Ray's kind of like stubborn male pride kind of being the only link he has with Chad now.
Okay, so that has played itself out then? I don't know. At this stage of the show where, like, this episode of the show where he realizes.
But him leaving, like, if we think that leaving Chad is the right thing to do, then that doesn't, like, you know, a tragic flaw of hubris would have him charge in to contest the custody and get his family in real problems or real, you know, do something to really horrifically scar up Chad beyond what he's already done.
Does he need to?
I mean, there's 2.5 more episodes to go, I suppose, where he could fuck that up.
But he seems like he's turned the corner on it.
Frank.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of hubris in Frank.
Is it really hubris or is it like, I can't, it's probably a good idea to quit while I'm ahead, but I'm not going to quit by my head because I'm not going to settle for less than what I think. I guess that is pride. I'm not going to settle for less than what life owes me.
Yeah. It seems to me like, you know, especially him getting back into this old game that he was part of, he believes that he's still a major player in that. And I feel like he's kind of out of his element at this point, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And he doesn't believe so. He keeps protesting and saying, nope, I'm here and I'm here to stay. So deal with it. But I don't know that he is.
Annie.
Yeah.
Annie seems like the number one suspect for suffering from her overabundance of pride.
With her just being so gung-ho about these operations that are pathetically thought out, pathetically orchestrated, it seems like, she's super confident in her abilities, and they may fail her when she needs them most.
Her Ginsu knife routine was pretty badass, though.
Totally. Yeah.
Like, seeing, like, because when
but
she
But she's
was
also
doing...
there saying, yeah, I'm a badass. I know how to take care of myself.
I just remember when I was watching her practice on the wooden doll, I'm like, this is kind of silly. But then seeing her do those exact same moves on a human body and how quickly that incapacitated the guy, it's kind of like, I said it's kind of like a reverse. You know, remember in Game of Thrones where the old bear got betrayed?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's like you think he's actually going to be able to strangle this guy. And then, nope, you've lost too much blood. It's all over.
Yeah.
That was like the inverse of that. It's like, no. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, hey, fuck yeah. I thought it was really cool. Fuck you, dude.
I did too. I thought it was amazing. But yeah, I think she's pretty headstrong. And that could be a problem for her.
All right. Let's talk about the full moon theory.
What's that?
A full moon's the best time to ratify alliances. It was prominently a full moon in this episode. Somebody looked up on one of the many astronomical sites, you know, you can look up when the full moon is at a particular time. And if, assuming we're thinking that this actually took place in 2014 and that future 2015.
Yeah.
September 9th, that was the invitation that had the Twin Peaks. That's funny because there's a lot of David Lynch stuff. And there's a Twin Peaks logo with I assumed it was a sun, but it could have been the moon.
Yeah.
In the background, a little gold, you know, symbol that that invitation was dated September 9th. Which was another night of the full moon.
So they're all werewolves? Is that what I'm getting here?
No. But there is some kind of connection to the full moon.
You think that's just...
Which implies that these people have another month to cool their heels before we'll have any other weird sex culty type action.
Yeah.
Does that imply that this is the... I mean, you yourself said that... They're going to have to find a whole new place and, you know, because honestly, I'm going to have a huge problem if they just fucking do this 28 days later at the same place.
That's so dumb.
I'd be over it.
Uh-huh.
So please, let's not have that happen. I don't know. The thread that was kind of put forth this theory was making full moon to be a noun because he doesn't say the full moon is the best time or when a full moon is in the air, it's the best time. He's like, full moon is the best time to ratify alliances. Like, you know, football season is the best time to drink beer. Like, that's not that like full moon might be the name of their organization. I don't know that I buy that.
Yeah.
And even if I do, what does it mean? Who cares?
I'm trying to. So do they worship some kind of god of the moon or like what, like Luna? What's going on here?
Well, I mean, there has been a lot of astrological...
Or is it just something like...
Or astronomical, cool, I should say. There's been a lot of astronomical things here, like the fucked up constellation of Orion.
Yeah.
I forget what the other weird thing in the sky. There's this kind of full moon thing. And also something I've been wanting to talk about for 3 weeks, and I've forgotten until right now, the one thing in the credits that nobody has analyzed is there's two shots of a planetary transit of the sun. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, yeah. I was reading like, on the forums.
When we're on Earth and, you know, the way that everything's kind of lined up in the solar system, every once in a while you can see like Mercury or Venus go across the surface of the sun if you have a telescope and don't burn your eyeballs out and all that.
It's not an eclipse because it doesn't cover the whole sun.
No, no, no. But it's called a transit. And there is two of those in the thing. You get the big full picture of the sun with all the solar flares and badass prominences, and you got the little planet trucking along. Mm-hmm. What the hell does that mean?
No fucking clue, man.
So
how is that tied in any way to the plot, right?
I don't know. It's the one thing that, like, you know, I feel like these pine trees are going to pay out. The camera with the woman, that's paying. Like, a lot of these things are actually coming to fruition and they mean something. But this planetary transit stuff, I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. So there's the full moon theory. We talked about the LAPD involvement of the diamond heist. There's also, this isn't exactly Psychosphere stuff, but it's, I think, if you just watch this episode one time and you listen to podcasts hoping to get all the nooks and crannies, there was a lot of people we saw at this party that you might have missed. Mm-hmm. For example, there is the former attorney general who's now running for governor of California.
Yeah, he's the one that I missed.
He was there talking to Blake.
Yep.
There's also, in one scene, the police chief of Vinci, mm-hmm. Tony Chisani, the mayor's son, Osip, the Anaconda Shark Man, and Mr. Catalyst.
Yeah.
All in one tight little knit group in this scene. So there's a lot of VIPs and people crucial to the plot at this party that I wanted to point out. And I've got photos of those in the show notes.
As I think, you know, we kind of suspected.
Here's the other theory that I don't know what to make of, and I don't like the larger theory, but the little tidbit I really liked. Someone did some digging around on the bartender, and she's got this line of dialogue when, you know, I'm talking about the Scarface woman that seems like she's got a shine to Ray, try to invite her on a vacation.
At Frank's bar.
Yeah. The Black Rose. She claims to be from San Miguel de Allende, which can be translated as Saint Michael from the beyond. Hmm. Now the Archangel Michael, not only does he lead heaven's armies against Satan in the Battle of Armageddon in the Book of Revelation, but he's also the patron saint of police officers and the military.
Okay.
She has a shine towards Ray. You know, Paul is a military officer and a policeman. Is she looking out for Ray? Because the larger theory that I took this tidbit was, is the Black Rose is essentially metaphysical purgatory. Hmm. And that she is Saint Michael is trying to usher Ray's soul into a good afterlife, out of purgatory, into like heaven. And she was upset with Antigone coming in there because she was going to try to ensnare his soul back into and keep him in this purgatory state. I don't know that I buy like all that analysis. Symbolism.
I mean,
but there's something with her being, we've talked about her being prominent because she's in a lot of the episodes and she's always got like prominent camera time, giving reactions and being concerned about Ray. Maybe she's involved with the Crow, maybe not. But being the patron saint of the police officers also would explain, if she is involved with the Crow, why the Crow wouldn't shoot Ray.
I'm discarding that theory, man.
The whole
that
what?
She's the Crow.
You don't think she's the Crow?
The Raven. Whatever.
What is the significance to the plot then?
I mean, it might just be that we're dealing with a man who was a professor of literature for a long time. He's going to throw symbolism into this stuff. And
just for its sake.
Yeah, just for its own sake. Yeah. And I think if you want to see like some sort of guiding voice for Rey, absolutely she could be it, because we've always seen her interacting with Rey in that particular way, right? Mm-hmm. She's always been kind to him, whereas all of the other things in Rey's life are negative influences.
I live it wide. Through layers of time you can't divide.
Bald Move depends on your support to create our independent podcast. Find out how you can help out and get lots of great perks such as ad-free podcasts, live video feeds, and other exclusive bonus content at club.baldmove.com. If you'd like to send in your feedback, you can do so by emailing it to truedetective@baldmove.com. You can find all of our content at baldmove.com and participate in our discussion forums. Keep up with our latest release schedules by liking us on Facebook or following us on Twitter.
I live among you.
well disguised.